From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, filling in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, Jerry Seinfeld. He stars in B-Movie, an animated feature opening in theaters this week. Seinfeld tells us why he considers himself a hookless comic. His self-titled sitcom ran for 9 seasons, getting laughs and creating memorable lines from life's most trivial moments. Also, Made in China. We talk with journalist James Fallows about the astonishing pace of industrialization in the world's most populous country. Fallows talks about the people who live, eat, and sleep in Chinese factories and the economic, cultural, and environmental impact of their work. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, senior writer for the Philadelphia Daily News, filling in this week for Terry Gross. It's hard to believe it, but it's been 9 years since Jerry Seinfeld made the last episode of his hit TV series. At 53, Seinfeld is now married, has 3 children, and has returned to stand-up comedy. But for much of the last 4 years, he's worked to bring his unique brand of humor to a new medium. Seinfeld is a writer, producer, and co-star with Renee Zellweger of Bee Movie, an animated feature about a bee who learns about life outside the hive and eventually sues humanity for stealing honey. In this scene, Seinfeld, as Barry B. Benson, is talking to his parents, played by Barry Levinson and Kathy Bates, about whether he wants to follow his dad's career path and spend his life stirring honey.
Dad, do you ever get bored doing the same job every day?
Son, let me tell you something about stirring. You grab that stick and you just move it around and you stir it around. You get yourself into a rhythm. It's a beautiful thing.
You know, Dad, the more I think about it, maybe the honey field just isn't right for me.
And you were thinking of what? Making balloon animals? That's a bad job for a guy with a stinger.
Well, no.
Janet, your son's not sure he wants to go into honey.
Oh, Barry, you are so funny sometimes.
I'm not trying to be funny.
You're not funny. You're going into honey. Our son, the stirrer.
You're
going
to be a stirrer?
No one's listening to me.
Wait till you see the sticks I have for you.
I can say anything I want right now. I'm going to get an ant tattoo.
Let's open some fresh honey and celebrate.
Maybe I'll pierce my thorax.
To honey.
Shave my antenna.
Honey.
Check up with a grasshopper. Get a gold tooth. And start calling everybody dogs.
I spoke to Jerry Seinfeld when he was in Philadelphia recently. Well, Jerry Seinfeld, welcome back to Fresh Air. You've spent years fine-tuning your stand-up material, and I know you work it meticulously. How is writing a screenplay different?
The trouble with it is you have the story, which is such a nuisance. You know, in stand-up, you just tell the funny part. But in a movie, the audience demands that you tell them some sort of story that makes sense. And this was a tremendous handicap for me, because it frankly doesn't interest me that much.
The story.
Yeah. Right. But you do have to have one. And so, and it has to work. And the funny thing I found is when the story works, the jokes work better. So I had to work on, the jokes came easily, but figuring out the story of what happens to this bee and how he gets involved with the humans and how everything goes wrong and how to make it all come out right in the end and make it funny all the way, really taxed my feeble little brain.
you have a context of a story as opposed to a stand-up act where you're grabbing that audience and taking them where you want them to go.
Yeah, nobody seems to care that you're jumping to a different subject every 90 seconds.
Right.
That's why I prefer stand-up.
Now, I read that Steven Spielberg was kind of a sounding board here. What kind of advice did he give you?
I'll tell you, he gave me some great advice, which I was ashamed to have to receive. The hardest part of telling the story is coming up with the end of the story that it's satisfying. You know, that after you've invested in these characters and kind of watched them go through this journey, that you feel good about where it all wound up. And at some point, I guess we were three-quarters of the way through making the thing, and I asked him to come in and look at it, and he watched it, and he said, you know, the last quarter of the movie, what happened to the silliness? What happened to all the fun and the silliness? And I said, well, I thought the ending should just be exciting and, you know, like the hero comes to save the day. He says, no, not in this movie. He says, you start off having all this fun and acting so goofy and silly, you have to maintain that all the way to the end. And, you know, as a comedian, it was pretty embarrassing to have to be told that by a guy who's really not known for being that funny.
Right. Jerry, you got to be funny here.
Yeah, Jerry, you should be funny here in this part of it. So that was actually a great piece of advice that he gave us. It was like that little, you know, you get close to something that you work on for a long time and you can't see what's wrong with it. And that was like a big key that kind of keep it silly.
You know, it's interesting that when you do stand-up, I mean, that's nothing is more autonomous than the stand-up comedian. It's his act, and the feedback is immediate. I mean, you go in, you bomb, whatever, you kill.
Maybe doing stand-up alone by yourself could be more autonomous.
Possibly. And the feedback would be even more immediate, maybe.
Right, that's right.
But, you know, a movie takes years. It's begins with endless meetings. Mm-hmm. There's endless editing. How did you adjust to the pace of it?
I didn't adjust very well, to be honest with you. It's it kind of goes against my natural instinct, which is I want to hear tonight if this is any funny or not. You have test screenings, and it was just like being strapped down for 4 years. You know, I know a lot of other comedy writers and comedians that would look at me and they would say, "You're still working on that movie?"
Right.
And I go, "Yeah, we're still going." I mean, 4 years, it's like I know people that wrote movies, got them produced, edited, released, went on to other movies.
We're speaking with Jerry Seinfeld. He is the producer and star of the new animated movie, B-Movie. I wanted to talk a little bit about your stand-up, which has, you know, been your core for years. And I wanted to play a clip. And this is not you at a club. It's actually a clip from an appearance on Letterman. And I got it from the documentary you did, Comedian. Uh-huh. And the context here is this is after the show has been off the air for a while, and you're coming back, and it's a TV appearance. I don't know if you remember this. Let's listen.
Thank you. I appreciate that. I totally appreciate what you're saying. I do, but the question is this. What have I been doing? Everybody says to me, "Hey, you don't do the show anymore. What do you do?" I'll tell you what I do. Nothing. Yeah, I know what you're thinking. That sounds pretty good. You're thinking, I might like to do nothing myself. Well, let me tell you, doing nothing is not as easy as it looks. You have to be careful. Because the idea of doing anything, which could easily lead to doing something, that would cut into your nothing, and that would force me to have to drop everything.
And that's Jerry Seinfeld, our guest from an appearance on the David Letterman show many years ago. You know what I love about that clip is that you got four or five really good laughs out of what, one joke?
Nothing.
No, hardly a joke. I mean, and it shows all those years in clubs. You've just got the pacing and the punch exactly where you want it.
Thank you.
And I mean, I know you spent all those years. You made your first appearance on The Tonight Show in 1981.
Mm-hmm.
And through the 80s, you're building a reputation as a stand-up, at a time when there are a lot of other comedians that are out there that are maybe getting more attention by being outrageous or profane or kind of using props or crazy characters. And I wondered, you know, kind of gave them an identity and a hook. Did you ever try that stuff, or were you ever tempted to try it?
No, I never was. And I always felt like I was very much a hookless comedian, and I would always be hookless. And that, I thought, maybe that's my hook, you know, that I just don't have anything that you latch on to as he's the guy who does this or looks like this. And, but it wouldn't have felt right anyway. I mean, that was kind of the joke about the show, was that it was about nothing. But what it really was about was the way we executed it. And it's the same thing as what my stand-up is about. It's the same thing as what that joke was about. What is that joke? It's taking the word nothing, something, everything, and anything, and assembling it into a thought that makes sense. And so that's really what I like to do. I'm more into the execution than I am anything other aspect of it. I mean, I don't even care about being famous or being, you know, I just enjoy the doing of the thing.
Well, you know, in the documentary Comedian, which is, you know, for those who haven't seen it, it's you going back to stand-up after having done the show and kind of getting back into it. And there's this moment in it that I really love where you've sort of built the act up toward, you've now got a good 50 minutes, and you do an appearance, I think, at a club in Washington, D.C., and it seems to have gone pretty well, but after it, you're not satisfied, and you're saying, God, it's just so hard to really feel comfortable, and you're kind of bemoaning whether you really hit it as you're packing your stuff and getting into your private jet, or what looks like your private jet.
Yeah.
And so what's fascinating is we have you who have all that money and success that insist on subjecting yourself to this ego-battering process of getting back in live clubs.
Mm-hmm.
You always want to do that. Why?
You know, it's just that feeling of not cheating. that is the, I think, the best feeling in life. I didn't cheat at that. And stand-up is the only thing that I knew that I could be sure that I, if I was doing it and audiences were responding well, that I wasn't cheating. Because there is no way to cheat in stand-up. It's the nakedest, purest thing in the world. But I could have gone into a movie. Someone would have said, we have a great idea for a movie for you. And they could have put me in a movie and promoted the movie. And the movie did this. And I would never know, was that any good or not?
Right.
You know, say, well, the director didn't handle you right. Or it wasn't promoted the way it should have been. And there's always a million excuses. There's no excuses in stand-up. So after all of that experience of Hollywood and television and everything that the show did, I just wanted to get back to something that I knew what was right and wrong and what was black and white. And it's a very black and white world. And that was a calming to me. And that was, it just would make me feel, I just never wanted to feel like I was skating on a reputation or, you know.
And you can't skate on a reputation at a live club.
No, absolutely not.
Even if you're Jerry Seinfeld.
Even if you're Jerry Seinfeld. Maybe a couple of minutes. They may give you 3 or 4 free minutes at the top. But after a while, no one laughs at a reputation. It's not funny.
And did you get where you wanted to be? Did you get comfortable?
I did finally. It took about 4 or 5 years of working. And I've lost it a little bit now doing the movie, and I'm going to go back. But it's kind of a tennis game. A stand-up act is like a tennis game. And even if you're good, you got to keep playing if you want to keep that game at a certain point.
And you're sure you want to keep playing?
I love the simplicity of it. I love the purity of it. It's just, this is what the, I mean, all this work that we went into the movie, I mean, to make an animated movie, the infrastructure of DreamWorks is $1 billion. That's what it costs just to have the machines to make one of these things. And then the years of work. And what is it all for? It's so that when we put it in front of the audience, you hear a laugh.
Same thing as standing up and telling a joke, right?
Same thing. So, you know, I like, it's the difference between, you know, you say you like the water. Well, you can be the captain of a ship or you can surf.
Right.
And stand-up's like surfing. You're just right there with it.
We're speaking with Jerry Seinfeld. He stars and produces a new movie called B-Movie. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. You're just joining us. Our guest is Jerry Seinfeld. He has written, produced, and stars in the new movie, B-Movie. Well, since you were last on Fresh Air, you did this TV series, which kind of took off.
Right.
It's a sort of a measure of its cultural reach. You know, my wife had a career change this year, and she had about 6 weeks between her old job and when she began her new life as a resident in psychiatry, which was in June and July, and I began referring to this time, which she'd look forward to so much, as her Summer of George, which, for folks who may not recall, was the Seinfeld episode where George Costanza has a summer off and he buys an easy chair with a built-in refrigerator.
Right.
And what's funny about it is that, you know, when I kind of came up with that phrase, everybody in my family laughed and talked about it. She would talk about her friends. They all knew exactly what we were talking about.
Right.
And in a way, those... That series, which you haven't made a new episode in 9 years now, mm-hmm. but it's all over a television, mm-hmm. is sort of this book of life. I mean, people use moments and lines from that series to describe what's going on in their lives. You're aware of this phenomenon.
I am, but I don't get it. I mean, it mystifies me as much as you, and I'm only happy that it's doing something for somebody.
That doesn't mystify me because you're capturing stuff that we all kind of recognize.
Right, but isn't every... Why is it different in other comedy shows? Why can't you name other comedy shows? Somebody, you know, Larry David said to me the other day that this was the first show where people would say, well, that's a Seinfeld episode about something that I had a day today that sounds like a Seinfeld episode. That our show was for some reason lent people to think like that about their own lives. Because I guess maybe one of the reasons is we stayed so close to the people's real lives. We tried to anyway, as much as we could, aside from, you know, hitting golf balls into the blowhole of a whale. And maybe that's why people can analogize to it to or from it.
Well, you know, it's interesting because I read a piece about you when you were doing stand-up, like maybe 89, when you were pitching the show to NBC, and you had made quite a reputation in the stand-up act and were just about to do a series. And there had then the LA Times actually had a full-time comedy writer who did a review of a show you did and was pretty critical.
Lawrence Christian.
That's the one.
Lawrence Christian, yeah.
And the criticism seemed to be, Seinfeld, yeah, he's a pro, his sets are funny, but there's sort of not enough, what, substance. There's not enough of a message.
Yeah.
And how ironic that, like, now all these years later, this is it's your stuff that kind of evokes the score of life.
Right. Yeah, that guy didn't like me. The reason he didn't like me, and I did not begrudge him for not liking me, is because I had a publicist at the time that put a sign in front of the theater that said, and I didn't know anything about this, he said, Jerry Seinfeld, master of observational comedy. And that's like, well, the show ends right there. You put that in front of your theater, no one's going to like you. You know, it's like, and now, ladies and gentlemen, please welcome the funniest man in the world. That's instant death. We'll follow that.
I mean, don't people hype all kinds of stuff? I mean, the audience loved the show, didn't they?
As we said, what my thing, it's a hookless act. It's a humble act, hopefully. You know, it's really about little things that are hopefully well observed. So, and so the guy, you know, so he just lit into me. It was an interesting moment because, yeah, the series was just beginning and then this horrible thing appears in the paper and everybody thought, oh, my God, is NBC going to get cold feet now and they're going to bail out on the series? But a lot of times there's always this thing with, well, he's no Richard Pryor, you know. And I always, you know, would apologize for not being raised by prostitutes in a whorehouse. There was just very little I could do about it, and I try to overcome it as best I can.
How did you know when it was time for the show to end?
If from my stage act, the stage act, you know, if I had been doing comedy, let's see, about 23 years at that time. And you start to know on stage when to get off. There's just this feeling that you develop from years and years of doing it. You just feel that we're getting, everyone's really having a good time. And I think in another few minutes, this is going to start to get old. Good night, everybody. And everyone's happy. And I'm sure you've had the experience, everyone's had the experience of going to a movie that you love, but for some reason they just make it 15 minutes longer than it really needed to be. And the change in your feeling about the movie, because of that little 15 minutes, and they may not even be a bad 15 minutes, it's just proportions. You know, I guess it's a function of art and an economy. That economy is essential to all good art. And I thought, even though we had done a lot, 9 years, 180 episodes, I thought, we can't do one too many or it's going to taint the whole thing. So it was more the energy I felt around the show itself.
That's what's interesting because on stage, you've got that, you have that sense from the audience that you've honed over the years.
Right. It was in the office. It was in the office of the show. The writers would come in and the way they would look at me. And when they would say, so I had a thought that maybe Kramer would, you know, become friends with a penguin or something, you know, and I would hear it in their voice. They're not as excited. This is getting old. And I thought, well, if it's happening here, the audience is next.
Right.
And you know, I had a meeting with Jack Welch, and he showed me these. It was a hilarious meeting where he
was the chairman of
GE at the time, and they owned NBC. And he had these charts of the ratings and the demographics of the show. And every chart showed the numbers going up. He said, you have improved your audience from the eighth season to the ninth. The ninth is stronger than the eighth. So it was so all backwards. You know, usually you go in there, you try and tell them why you deserve more money and why the show should be kept on. And it was everything was backwards. I'm telling him, no, we shouldn't go anymore. He says, no, you should. I'll give you a raise. I'll give you more money. You know, I said, I don't want money. I want the audience to have this thing. It was kind of like, and I don't mean to compare myself in any way, shape, or form to the Beatles, but when the Beatles ended, it was so sudden, and it made what they did somehow more valuable.
Right.
Because it just suddenly was over, and that's it. That's the complete set. You know, 9 years, 12 albums, whatever it is, that's it. So I kind of took from that, I want to try and do that.
You know, it's funny. I can't help but think of the episode in the series when George Costanza adopts this posture and in a meeting gets one funny line that cracks off a line that breaks the room up and he says,
right.
That's it. I'm done. I'm out of here.
That's where the idea came from.
Yeah, yeah. You know, the series was about these four adults, single adults in New York, living kind of very self-absorbed lives. You now have three kids. Mm-hmm. You have a whole family life. Mm-hmm. Are we going to see a whole new kind of material out of you? You
mean doing- I do talk about my kids and my wife a lot more. I say this in my act, is I don't talk with single guys. I'm not interested in them or their lives. That if you don't have a wife, we really have nothing to talk about. And they say, well, the guys will say, well, I have a girlfriend. I go, well, that's wiffle ball, my friend. You know, you're playing paintball war and I'm in Iraq with real guns.
It's the real thing.
Yeah.
Well, Jerry Seinfeld, I wish we had more time, but thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you. It was my pleasure.
Jerry Seinfeld is writer, producer, and co-star with Renee Zellweger of the new animated feature, B-Movie. I'm Dave Davies, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from PBS, airing tonight on Nova, How to Run a Marathon, followed by a look at the funeral business on Frontline, starts at 8, 7 Central on PBS. From Barnes & Noble and the Barnes & Noble Review, the new online literary magazine with reviews, interviews, and recommendations. And from Audible.com, where you can download and listen to Fresh Air, in addition to audiobooks, magazines, and newspapers. Audible.com/Fresh Air. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, you can't get away from it. James Fallow says every device you use to hear this show is made at least in part in China, by factory workers earning less than a dollar an hour, sleeping and eating on the site, working 10 hours a day, 6 days a week. But Fallow says you shouldn't feel too bad about it. He'll tell us why. This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, filling in for Terry Gross. My guest James Fallows made a startling observation in a recent piece in the Atlantic Monthly. According to his estimate, there are more manufacturing jobs in the southern China province of Guangdong than in the entire United States. Fallows is living in China these days, and he's written about the enormous scale, unique methods, and widespread impact of China's fast-paced industrial revolution. James Fallows is national correspondent for the Atlantic Monthly. He's written 7 books. His most recent is Blind into Baghdad, America's War in Iraq. I spoke to him last week about his reporting from the industrial city of Shenzhen in southern China, where hundreds of factories are located. Well, James Fallows, welcome back to Fresh Air. Describe a factory, one of these outside of Shenzhen that you visited.
Well, I'll describe one that I couldn't get into because it's like a military camp. The biggest one in that whole area, and probably the biggest factory complex on Earth that the Earth has ever seen, is a company called Foxconn. That's their English name. They have an office in Shenzhen. They are owned by a Taiwanese entrepreneur who's operated in southern China for a while. And in this one plant, something like 250,000 people go to work every single day. They live there. They eat there. They have this giant encampment. In scale, it reminded me most of, say, Los Angeles International Airport. That was about how big it was to drive around the periphery. The statistic I like best about this factory for Foxconn is that simply to feed its own workforce, the caterers have to kill 3,000 pigs every single day. You know, Chinese pigs are not that big, but still, it's a lot of pork going in there. The more typical factory, of which there are thousands probably in the Shenzhen area, these are factories that often produce electronics, shoes, light manufactured goods with a lot of hand labor. And the typical employee will be a young woman, maybe in her early or mid-20s, who's grown up in some other part of China in the provinces, in Sichuan province or some other rural area. And her family's income would have been about $100 a year in cash back on the farm. And when she goes to this factory in Shenzhen or neighboring city, she can make about $100 a month or $130 a month. And in the course of several years of this full-time factory work, living on the factory, eating in the factory, she can save essentially a lifetime savings. And so many of these people then either some of them stay in the city, but some of them after 3 or 4 years go back. And so you see these seas of young women all at the assembly line, in some cases heavy industry young men. And it's like, in a sense, a wartime effort. They spend 24 hours a day essentially on the factory complex. And for them, it's a good economic deal.
And so in these light manufacturing plants all throughout Shenzhen, are most of the employees women?
It does seem to go by the kinds of things they're making. For example, I've seen some big places where they're making air conditioners, and most of the people there were men. But if you think of the classic made-in-China good, for example, any headsets that people might be using to listen to this show right now, or actually, in fact, any audio equipment of any sort by which people are listening to this show, whether it's on a webcast or over the radio, that most likely came from a factory in China. And in factories like those, it is predominantly young women. And it's in those factories, you see a kind of hand labor that is simply not efficient to do in the Western world anymore because, you know, if you were paying people to snap things together one every 5 seconds, 10 or 12 hours a day, the wage rates would be prohibitive in the U.S.
Now, where do the employees live and eat?
There are in the typical factory, and I'm thinking of one now owned by a company that I won't name. Well, the company I won't name because I can't actually remember its name. It's one of many anonymous small Chinese-owned manufacturers, but they would do contract work for almost any brand name you can think of in the U.S. You know, whether it's, you know, name a brand name, and that company almost certainly has its manufacturing done in China. The employees there will. They will work on the assembly line for 8, 10, 12 hours a day, depending on the workflow, and live in a dormitory. And the dormitories range from pretty gruesome, of maybe 10 or 12 people or 14 people living in one small room and having essentially for themselves just a bunk area, to nicer than that, of having two or three people per room. They're not, by Chinese standards, they are tough but not abusive. And they will eat in company cafeterias. You know, they're free to eat other places, but three meals a day are basically part of the standard employment package in addition to the cash. So if these young women are looking to save up money to send back to their families or save themselves, they will live just in the dormitory, eat just in the company canteens, and that is their life for the several years.
You made a point in the piece that while some would regard these conditions as abusive or even equivalent to slavery, if you look at it, you believe that folks living this life are perhaps even better off than someone attempting to live on a minimum wage, say, in Chicago.
And let me stipulate, there are a lot of really abusive and terrible factories in China. And almost every day you'll see an item in the paper of somebody who, you know, 10 people blown up in a steel mill, or, you know, there was a horrible story of something like 36 or 37 people who were covered with molten steel in a steel plant one day, and of course all died. So there are many factories that are dangerous, rough. There were reports of sort of slave labor factories in the north of China recently, but the average factory, at least the ones I've seen, is not that way. They are instead quite tough and demanding. But from the Chinese perspective, this has been not 100% success, but a huge success for the country in the following sense, that if you think of India, the people in India who've been able to interact with the world economy and make their way up in the world are people who already have been educated and know enough English and enough sort of sophisticated information to work in a call center or to be part of some kind of software support. And that's a numbered in the single digits of millions of people in India who are able to do that. In China, it's many tens of millions of rural peasants who've been able to have a tenfold increase in their cash income by going to the factories. And the contrast with somebody on the minimum wage in the U.S., that a person, it is almost impossible for somebody on the minimum wage in the U.S. to move ahead. You know, saving, you can imagine scenarios in which people could save money and feel as if they could have a better future if they're on the minimum wage in the U.S. But anybody working in a factory in China knows that his or her future is much, much brighter than their families would have been, than their future would have been if they were still in the countryside, or than past generations of Chinese uneducated people have enjoyed. So in these factories, of course there are complaints. Of course there are searches for better situations. Of course there are things that need to be fixed. But the average sentiment in the factories, as I was able to find out about it, seemed to be that this was an opportunity from their point of view because they were having the equipment for a better life.
If you're just joining us, we're speaking with journalist James Fallows. He is living in China and studying industrialization there and writing for The Atlantic. China is still a one-party state and, at least in theory, a socialist country. Who owns all of these scores of factories in the Shenzhen area?
What exactly socialism and communism mean in China now is a very rich topic, and you could argue that China is communist China is less a welfare state than the United States is or any part of Europe, because there's no retirement program, no health insurance program for most people. The actual ownership of the means of production in the most productive parts of China is mainly through small business people, often Taiwanese. And the typical factory in southern China where the goods Americans buy every day ultimately come from, it will be probably a family-owned enterprise, more likely than not a family that has some ties to Taiwan and they've come across the straits to southern China to operate, or some small business from the area. But they're small enterprises in really cutthroat competition with each other to take this next 0.5% out of their bidding price to Dell or Hewlett-Packard or Sony or whoever they're doing the contract work for. So it's a more classic and really every single day competitive model of small-scale capitalism than we see in a lot of America now.
And so what we have in this area, this province north of Hong Kong, are hundreds and hundreds of small manufacturers and a kind of a frenetic competition, really, to supply international companies with parts and components of all kinds of things, a lot of them electronics, right?
Exactly.
And one of the points you make is that a Chinese company could respond very quickly to the need of an American manufacturer to bring on a new product line or to make a change in a component part. Why are these Chinese factories, which are so labor-intensive, able to deliver so quickly and so cheaply to these American these international needs?
I spent a lot of time in my reporting and in my article talking about a man named Liam Casey, who's one of the sort of he's one of a number of central figures in the whole outsourcing business. He exists to put Western branded companies in touch with Chinese manufacturing firms that can do their actual production work for them, either firms as large, let's say, as Apple, or firms as small as some startup that has an idea and needs to get it produced to bring to the American market. And a point that Liam Casey made to me again and again and again is that people think the Chinese manufacturing advantage is just that things are cheap. And of course, they are cheap. And if you have people making $100 a month, that's quite different from the U.S. Labor cost. But he said that even more than that, the profound advantage that Chinese manufacturing had now was that it was so fast and flexible and responsive and adaptable because all parts of the production chain were there in one place. If you needed to have a small piece of leather, you know, tooled in some way, you know, 1 inch by 4 inches with a certain number of perforations, there were five companies that could have you samples tomorrow afternoon. And if you were working in Dusseldorf or you're working in New York, you know, maybe you'd have one supplier, maybe they could do something next month. So it's this whole ramified network of all the different parts of the modern manufacturing experience, which now are more and more concentrated in China, in particular this part of southern China. And the companies, the firms that do the connections between the Western customers and the Chinese producers, their specialty is knowing how to put these pieces together, saying, you want this piece of plastic in red of just this dimension. Here are the five companies that can bid on it, and I'll have them all for you to see tomorrow, and you'll see who gets the business.
And this gentleman that you mentioned, who you describe as Mr. China, he's made kind of a life of, I think you said he has actual GPS coordinates for all kinds of Chinese manufacturing locations. Not stuff you can get in any directory or in any government registry, right? It's a matter of knowing the terrain?
Exactly. And part of the problem is that maps literally are out of date the instant they appear, because roads are being both built and destroyed so rapidly in China, and new factories and new buildings. And so knowing simply where things are is a big competitive advantage.
Our guest is James Filos. He's living in China and reporting on his experiences there for The Atlantic. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, we're speaking with journalist James Filos. He writes for The Atlantic. He is living in China now and has been writing about industrialization there. You say in the piece that 90% of the laptop and notebook computers sold in the world under all these famous brand names come from Chinese companies in this part of southern China. Is that right?
Yes, it is. And it doesn't matter that you can name any brand a notebook computer, whether it's a ThinkPad, whether from Lenovo or IBM or a Sony or an HP or a Dell, or you go down the list, and it is almost certain that it comes from one of five no-name Taiwanese companies that have these factories in China, some around Shanghai, some in southern China. They do the actual production of almost all the notebook and laptop computers in the world.
One of the interesting sections of your piece in The Atlantic detailed how an online order would come in for Liam Casey's company and exactly how quickly the factory would respond and get it out. If you could just kind of run that down for us.
I enjoyed very much seeing this place, so I'll tell you the process. And once again, I can't tell you the name of the American brand this is sold under, although I guarantee that every single person listening to this knows the name of this American-based consumer electronics company. So this company has a website, and on the website, people can order devices, they can order accessories, they can order all kinds of stuff, like any other website you go to for a major American brand product. There's a 12-hour time difference between the U.S. East Coast and China time. So the factory in China works sort of on reverse from American time. And while I was there in the wee hours of the morning, China time, which was late afternoon in America, I saw a person, a man, in fact, from Palatine, Illinois, who was browsing around on the website, you know, for this American manufacturer, and saw something he wanted and clicked on the Buy Now button. And within a few seconds, 10,000 miles away in Shenzhen, the order form was printed out, complete with a barcode. And the barcode specified all the details. So on the other end of the internet, this order comes out, and a series of young Chinese women took it. The first one scanned it in and then produced the address label that would be used for this man. It also had the packing box. Next person on down started putting in the main thing this person had ordered. The next one on down checked the barcode and had a so-called pick-to-light process, where there was a big, essentially a wall-sized array of little tiny cubbyholes, like a post office box array. And whatever item had been called for by the barcode specs, the light would go on over that thing. And so the young woman would pick off that accessory. She would run its barcode across a scanner, like in a grocery store, put it into the box. At that point, there would be a very, very sensitive scale, which would say, okay, we know these three components are supposed to be in here. Does the weight in grams equal exactly what we think it should be? It would go then to the next person, who would rescan the things to make sure they were fine, and somebody else to pack it up. And then the interesting part to me is they were put into these shipping boxes and then assembled on big shipping pallets, you know, maybe a cube essentially 5 feet in all dimensions. And these were for the shipping company, either FedEx or DHL or UPS, to pick up, you know, a few hours later. And when the shipper's deadline came, pickup time, let's say it's 9 a.m. China time, 9 p.m. U.S. East Coast time, suddenly all activity in the factory in China was focused on this moment. The shippers would come in, they'd take off these pallets, and they'd rush them to Hong Kong Airport. On the flights to Anchorage, there'd be some preliminary sorting, you know, which ones to the East Coast, which ones to the West Coast, and they'd all be arrayed. And within 36 hours of the time the customer in Illinois clicked on the Buy Now button, you know, triggering this event, the package would show up at his or her door, you know, via FedEx.
It's fascinating to read these descriptions of these factories and kind of the level of competition and how integrated they are into international markets. But let's look at, evaluate it a bit. Is this good for China? How do you read it?
From the Chinese perspective, I would have to say, as I think most Chinese people feel, this is overwhelmingly good from a Chinese perspective. Here are the bad parts. One bad part from the Chinese perspective is the U.S. has effectively outsourced a fair amount of pollution to China. You know, as factories have gone, so have factory smokestacks and all the rest. And the pollution in China is unbelievably horrible. It's the single greatest threat that country faces, and I think the world faces, because of China's industrialization. So that is one cost they absorb. A second cost they absorb is there is some downside to factory life, where young men and women are spending 3 or 4 years, you know, just essentially on full-time labor detail. This is hard on them. It's hard on their families. It has all kinds of, you know, there are social side effects of alienation, drug use, crime, and all the rest that have been part of industrialization through history. That is a problem. And there are, you know, the side effects of kind of uncontrolled growth. Those are the things which would be problems from the Chinese point of view. On the other hand, you do now have tens of millions of people, perhaps, you know, 100 million people or more, who have, thanks to the factory life, been able to make the leap from really hand-to-mouth existence on the farm to having enough cash that they can have other choices. They can pay for their children to go to school. They can set up little businesses. They can get married. And so I think the Chinese view their factory life as being the great success story of the last generation.
Our guest is James Follows. He is living in China these days and writing about his experiences for The Atlantic. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. You're just joining us. We're speaking with journalist James Fallows. He has been living in China, where he is writing about that country's efforts at industrialization for The Atlantic. One of the questions that comes to mind as you look at the industrialization in China is whether a one-party state can continue to rule over a country which becomes more urban and more part of a capitalist monetary economy. I mean, do you see signs that of you know, what is in effect a kind of a backward and corrupt political structure straining against or struggling with the needs of capitalists to do what they need to do?
You know, this is a fascinating and rich question which people in China, especially outsiders, but a number of Chinese too, debate every single day. And I think nobody has any confidence in predicting what will happen in the long run. My observation of the tension between the political system and the economic system is a little different from what I think the normal outside American observation would be. You know, we usually think as a country prospers, it has to become more democratic or else it'll be cut off. I think the limit on China is slightly different from that. You know, China, as I've been saying, at the moment is very, very strong in quite low-wage manufacturing jobs. The question, you know, their hope, America's apprehension, is whether they can move to take the higher-level positions too. And it's observed around the world that those higher-level positions, you know, having fundamental new inventions, having really good industrial designers, having real product innovations, so you're not just making an existing product cheaper, but you're coming up with a truly new one, they're associated with democratic societies, but even more, I think they're associated with another set of traits. They're associated with very strong universities where you can have independent research. China's universities are quite weak. You know, they're not good in independent research at all. They're associated with intellectual property protection so that people can make money from their inventions. China's intellectual property protection is ridiculously weak. You know, everything is up for grabs from everybody. They're associated with rule of law and sanctity of contract. If you make a deal, you'll have a deal, which is generally not the case in China. They're associated with a kind of ethic of trust so that people can operate without everything having to be written down. And there's quite a pronounced lack of trust in China, which is why firms are typically so small. They don't trust, you know, what people who are not in their families to operate. And so I am persuaded of the argument that for China really to take the next step in prosperity, it needs to have a lot of these other cultural conditions, better universities, a more trustworthy legal system, better copyright laws and all the rest. The question is, does that mean a democratic political system too? I think for China to really prosper in a profound way, it would need to be a society of civil liberties and a more society of kind of independent inquiry and independent voices. Whether that means actual political competition for power and having some other party besides the communists in the mix, I just don't know. And I think the calculation of the current leadership is they think they can stick with this model for a while.
Do you see signs that workers in Chinese factories are restive, that they feel exploited and maybe want to organize unions or seek redress of grievances from the government or their owners?
This is one of many places where I should say that you know, anybody who presumes to say what's happening in, quote, China, unquote, is nuts because it's so big and so diverse. So I can talk about what I've seen in a lot of factories in one part of China. My impression is that there are... You know, the workers there are by no means docile and by no means just satisfied with whatever happens. And one reason why at a lot of work sites, mobile phones are outlawed is that Chinese people love mobile phones. Almost everybody has them, even peasants, and they send text messages around the clock. And in the factories, they'll often be sending text messages saying, hey, we can get, you know, 2 RMB a day more at this other factory. Come to this other factory. So mobile phones are a way of both complaining about conditions and seeking better options. And there is considerable activity among Chinese workers. In the factories I saw, however, there was neither some sense of sullen oppression and people just looking to rise up against the man and overthrow them and, you know, lash out against their hated oppressors. More it was people who were working very, very hard to get their money. Nor were unions really the answer, because in unions, in China, unions are essentially another branch of the state. China is the only part of the world where Walmart is unionized, and they had to be, to operate there. And essentially, the unions work as part of the Communist Party structure, so they're not really a way to exercise leverage for what we think of as real workers' rights.
How much has Chinese manufacturing been damaged by the scandals over, food contamination? There was dog food, toothpaste.
I think that there is a clear sense in China that the so-called China brand has been very, very seriously hurt by all the legitimate problems they've had. And by legitimate, I mean real problems, or not just a perception of unsafe Chinese products, but the reality of that. The reaction in the Chinese press has been interesting to me, in that the minor theme has been, the foreigners are blaming us, they're picking on us, they have their own bad products too, it's not just us. The major theme has been, this is a problem for us, we need to clean it up, what are the ways we can redress it? So they recognize, on the one hand, that when consumers have options in the Western world, they may steer away from Chinese vegetables or Chinese processed food or Chinese toothpaste. And the people in China don't have that much choice. But there are a whole lot of things in which, for Western consumers, the Chinese component is either not obvious or it's not avoidable. If you wanted to buy a non-Chinese-made computer, well, good luck. You're not going to find one. So I think they recognize this is, like pollution, a genuine problem, and dealing with it is another issue.
Well, James Fallows, thanks so much for speaking with us.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
James Fallows is national correspondent for The Atlantic Monthly. You can download podcasts of the show at freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our senior producer this week is Roberta Shorrock. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Sue Spolin directed the show. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.
Support for NPR comes from The Dial Press, publisher of The Rabbi's Daughter by Reva Mann, a memoir about a young woman's search to find her place within her traditional community. From TIAA Cref, putting the heart of a nonprofit to work for the financial future of those who serve the greater good. That's powerof.org. And from Warner Home Video and Netflix, presenting The Reaping, starring Hilary Swank and directed by Stephen Hopkins, on DVD and high def at Netflix.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Peta Thornycroft tells us about life as one of the few remaining independent reporters left in Zimbabwe, where the economy is collapsing and the rate of inflation exceeds 5,000%. Thornycroft renounced her British citizenship so she could remain in the country and keep reporting. Join us for the next Fresh Air.